It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a look at Democratic and Republican bills that have the goal of making childcare more affordable. First, on Monday, President Biden announced new federal regulations on privately assembled firearms. Sometimes called ghost guns, they don't have serial numbers, and they're basically impossible to trace. Police around the country have reported seizing more and more of them from criminal use. The new rules aim to regulate home-built guns in similar ways to commercially sold firearms in an effort to cut back on black market distribution. We're learning more about the rise of ghost guns and what impact the new regulations could have. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about these gun kits, these so-called ghost guns? Are you glad to see the Biden administration trying to regulate them? Do you think the regulations went too far or not far enough? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alex McCourt is an assistant professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health. He also works in the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions. Alex, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
As I understand it, Alex, these so-called ghost guns can come in a lot of different forms, different kinds of kits. Could you give us a broad stroke definition of what these things are and how they work?
Sure. So these guns are generally guns that lack serial numbers. This is distinct from the type of gun that is a traditionally manufactured gun that lacks a serial number because it's been obliterated. So these are guns that lack serial numbers by design. They could be constructed from individual parts. Those parts might be purchased separately, or they might be purchased as part of a kit, or they might be 3D printed. And those are really the primary ways that these guns are made.
How common are these things? How available are these things now?
So we don't have very good data on this. It's very difficult to track gun ownership and use in general. And that's even more true for these guns that are, by definition, untraceable. What we do know from both federal data, federal reports and law enforcement data is that use of these guns seems to be increasing. And that could be because they're very available. It's very easy to order these online, and really anybody is able to do it.
How easy are these to assemble? I've heard it's not like snapping together a Lego kit, but it's easier than, you know, building a firearm from raw materials.
Yeah, that's about right. It's not as simple as Legos or really probably many different hobbies, but it is pretty straightforward. There are some that advertise being able to be constructed in 30 minutes or less, but really, even if it takes several hours or a day, that's pretty quick to be able to go from having just the component parts to having a functioning firearm.
So here we have the Biden administration looking to have these new regulations. Here's a clip from his announcement back on Monday.
All of a sudden, it's no longer a ghost. It has a return address. It's going to help save lives, reduce crime, and get more criminals off the streets.
What in these new requirements would require that kind of return address, that equivalent of a serial number that would be on a firearm that you would traditionally buy?
So what this rule would do is bring these guns in line with your traditional gun. So traditionally, when a gun is recovered by law enforcement, it has a serial number and some other markings on it. And law enforcement and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, ATF, can use that information to figure out who the manufacturer is and trace it from there. Where did it go for retail sale? And from there, who was it sold to? And the goal, obviously, is to get to the person that ultimately used the gun in crime. Right now, these guns are untraceable, these ghost guns or these privately made firearms. What this rule would do is require that these kits or these individual parts have serial numbers on them. That would mean that when a gun that was made from a kit was recovered by law enforcement, it would be traceable.
Now, I could see a various group of people being interested in this. One, maybe just a firearms, a home hobbyist who, you know, like some people like to build computers for kits. They think, yeah, I'd like to make my own gun from a kit. all the way over to people who want untraceable guns for very specific criminal reasons. Do we know much about the market and who's buying these things?
We don't know very much about it. We do know that there have been very high-profile uses of these guns and these kits in gun trafficking and also in some mass shootings, including school shootings. There have also been individuals that told law enforcement that they specifically sought out these guns because they had no other way of accessing guns because they were prohibited from buying a traditional gun. However, there are some people who just like to build guns at home, and they like to engage in that as a hobby. Importantly, the rule that was put out is really clear that this doesn't do anything to stop you from making your own gun at home. It has more to do with the serial numbers that are on these specific kits and who can sell those and manufacture them, and what licensed dealers and licensed manufacturers can do with those. So there's still nothing stopping someone from building their own gun for personal use.
We're talking to Alex McCord from Johns Hopkins University with the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions, looking at these gun kits that allow people to build guns at home, of various paths to get there. As we've heard, new regulations from the Biden administration aim to treat them more like existing commercially sold guns, including requiring identifying serial numbers. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe if you've made one of these, ordered one of these yourself. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We'll bring on a caller now. Hans is with us in Kaukauna. Hans, hello.
Hello. I wanted to mention that criminals are criminals by definition. They're already breaking the law. All those who do it make criminals of people who are often will make criminals of people who are not criminals, restrict the rights of people. And the thing about it, I just don't see where it's going to help anything prevent crimes, because bad people are going to do bad things. We really have to go after the motivation of the criminals, go after. We're not even forcing the laws we have in place. It's another law that's going to be restrictive to good people.
Well, Hans, I want to get your thought on this. The idea, at least the argument from the Biden administration, is this is taking the existing laws that apply to something you might buy, like at a traditional firearm store, and just applying it to this kind of new science fiction category of guns. Do you think that's okay, or do you worry about that?
Well, part of the reason that some people I know have built these things is because as soon as there's a serial number on it that has to be registered through a federal firearms license dealer, that gives a place for people to confiscate, for the government to confiscate the firearms of the people. Many people that I know in the culture want these to prevent confiscation of their firearms, because part of the reason people have firearms is to protect from both domestic and foreign enemies, and that's a true thing. And a domestic enemy can be our own government if they become, even Donald Trump. I said, who's going to stop? Who's going to protect your First Amendment rights if you don't have your Second Amendment rights in place?
Hans, thanks for the call. Alex, I think Hans pointing toward a motivation, as he said, from people, the culture he was referring to there, wanting non-traceable guns to prevent government confiscation. What do you think of that argument?
I think it's really fascinating, and it's not a, it's an important argument to consider. I think it's also incredibly common that when the ATF put out its proposed rule, it got hundreds of thousands of responses, and many of them were very similar to what Hans said. There's this concern that this will make criminals out of people that are law-abiding citizens, and it will affect their right to have a gun in the home for self-defense. Importantly, I think there's this idea of criminals that criminals will be criminals and they'll be able to access guns. But what we're seeing is actually many law enforcement agencies that are reporting increases in these guns are in states that have particularly strong gun laws. And these gun laws, like purchaser licensing and extreme risk protection orders, make it more difficult to get a gun for someone who is at high risk of harming themselves or others. So maybe that's somebody who has a criminal history, or maybe it's just someone who is at risk of self-harm. But when they're not able to access a gun, they are able to access these kits. There's no background check requirement, and the prohibitions at the federal and state level don't kick in for these kits. As a result, we see people who have violent felony convictions, domestic violence convictions, and even children that are able to get these kits and construct guns.
Hans, thanks for that call. We're talking about so-called ghost guns, these home gun construction kits and new Biden administration regulations with Johns Hopkins University public health professor Alex McCourt. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this concept new to you? Do you have questions about how it works, or are you very familiar with it? Have you ordered and assembled one of these firearms at home yourself? What do you think of the idea of regulating them, requiring serial numbers on these homemade guns or home assembled guns? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with Professor Alex McCourt from the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Prevention, with us today to talk about home-built firearms, known as ghost guns by some, as the Biden administration starts implementing new regulations requiring them to have serial numbers, among other things. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about these home gun kits? Are you worried about them, or do you think they're a good idea? What do you think about the idea of regulating them a little more like existing firearms? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go back to your calls now with James in Fall Creek. Hey, James.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, James?
Well, there's a couple of points that should be brought out, and I'm speaking for the state of Wisconsin. In the past, there have been many, many, many guns that without serial numbers that were produced. They were standard shotguns, Winchester Model 37, for example. All of the Stevens guns, they didn't have serial numbers. And then on top of that, in Wisconsin at least, where we have the right to transfer a gun to a private individual, or to a private individual, there is no actual tracing of serial numbers. If you go to a gun show in Wisconsin, you can purchase a gun. It may have a serial number, but that gun is not tracked.
Got it. James, thanks for the call. Alex, James pointing toward some gaps in serial number and serial number tracking with existing guns. Forget, you know, even setting aside the so-called ghost guns for the moment.
Yeah, James is absolutely right that there are many private sales where serial numbers are not tracked. And so this is often a stumbling block for law enforcement, but also arguably a protection for some individuals who like to privately transfer their guns and are not dealing with federally licensed dealers. And this rule would not change that. So if somebody made a gun from a kit that had a serial number on it and then transferred it in a private transfer, as long as they're in a state that does not regulate those private transfers, that is just like a traditional gun. So these are not special rules for privately made guns, but are rather just bringing them in line with all other guns.
James, thanks for that call. We got an email from Matt in Madison who says, one of the reasons they caught the shooter in New York City so quick is because they could trace the purchase to a 2011 purchase, the firearm. The fact that ghost guns even exist is a testimonial, he says, to the right's dismissal of any gun management. I will say I'm following this story in the news just like everybody else. Alex, I don't know the exact details of what led to the apprehension there, but the traceability of the firearm used, I know that is part of the story here.
Yeah, I'm in a similar position that I don't know the details, but I had heard that it was a gun that was not a ghost gun that had a serial number. And I think when guns are recovered that have serial numbers, it can be an important tool for law enforcement to try to investigate who was behind an act of violence. And it can also help identify individuals who were involved in straw purchases and gun trafficking.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Nate is on the line in Monona. Hi, Nate.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I see no reason not to have serial numbers on every gun that's produced. The majority of people who are doing that are people who are trying to avoid the law. Those people are a threat to everybody in society. So there's, all these arguments are bogus. Somebody who wants to make guns, they can make guns regardless of whether they got a serial number or not. The argument about Stevens guns, those are old antique guns. I don't even know if Stevens is still manufacturing guns.
I gotcha, Nate. Thanks for the call. Nate, seeing the main purpose of these non-serial numbered ghost guns, Alex, being for people with bad intent. As you say, we don't necessarily have the numbers on that, but there is that concern.
Absolutely, there is that concern. And because we don't have data, it's difficult to say whether that is the primary motivation for purchasing these kits or manufacturing these guns. But it certainly makes a lot of sense that individuals who want to get a gun and want to make sure that nobody knows they have it and that it can't be traced if they lose it or discard it after using it in a crime, these guns are appealing for those individuals.
Thanks for that call. We are talking to Alex McCord from the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Prevention, looking at home gun kits, gun making kits, sometimes called ghost guns, new Biden administration regulations, trying to give them the similar serial numbers to firearms you might buy at a gun store. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Kathleen is on the line now in Delavan. Hi, Kathleen.
Yeah, hi. I'll stay right up in front. I have no understanding of how people with the frontier mentality of the right to own guns with no restrictions or registration, how they justify that, because the concern of them, this mass federal task force going door to door, taking guns when we're losing 45,000 people a year due to guns, so that's nearly 500,000 in 10 years. I just don't understand how that equates. That's my only comment.
Kathleen, thanks for the call. Alex, can you talk about the toll of gun violence? And Kathleen doesn't seem to worry about door-to-door gun confiscations being likely.
Yeah, gun violence is a massive problem, especially in the United States. Compared to peer nations, the U.S. has a disproportionate rate of firearm violence. And during the COVID-19 pandemic, we've seen big increases in firearm homicide. And I think it's really important in this conversation when we're talking about these guns to again underscore that they undermine a lot of the kind of policy solutions that we have put in place in certain states that try to reduce gun violence and try to keep guns away from those at high risk of harming themselves or others. In terms of going door to door and taking guns, that is a common fear among some gun owners. There are protections in place, however, laws that prohibit the creation of a federal registry of guns. So there's no indication that would ever happen. And in fact, there is a Second Amendment right to own a handgun in the home for self-defense, provided you're not prohibited from possessing.
Thanks for that call. John joins us now in Madison. John, hi.
Yeah, I used to own a gun. I sold it. I think guns are very good for hunting. You want to carry a sidearm with you. You wound an animal and it's you're hunting, you shoot it. I think really what comes down to is the gun manufacturers want to scare people into buying guns. They give millions of dollars to politicians to help them support. They want to, if they don't sell guns, they're out of business. They want to scare people to buy guns, and politicians help them scare people.
John, thanks for the call. What do you think, Alex?
You know, it's interesting. There is some research that has shown that in times of high stress or high, kind of fear in society, purchases of guns increase. And we actually saw record-breaking gun purchases during the first year in 2020 of the COVID-19 pandemic, as people were feeling less safe, less sure about everything. And many of those purchases were first-time gun owners who felt the need to go buy a gun. So there is something to be said for fear being a driver of gun ownership.
Thanks for that call. Alex, in our last minute or so, we have these regulations announced. There is a process. When would these come into effect? And when do you see them starting to be enforced? Or is there likely to be a big legal challenge? We might not see this in place for a while.
So the rule should go into effect in about 120 days. So about 4 months, we'll see it go into effect. That said, there will almost certainly be a legal challenge that legal challenge could originate in many different areas. It could be a constitutional challenge. It also could be a challenge to ATF's authority. Experts, I think, generally agree that there is not a very firm basis for many of those legal challenges, but we are certainly going to see them. But provided there is no holdup in the courts, this regulation should go into effect this in about 4 months.
Alex, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Alex McCourt works in the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions and is an assistant professor in the Department of Health, Policy, and Management. He joined us for a look at these so-called ghost guns, guns that can be made or assembled from kits, and new proposed regulations announced this week by the Biden administration that would treat them like commercially available firearms, especially as regards identifiable serial numbers. Still time for you to share your thoughts. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up after the news, a lot of Americans are struggling with the cost of childcare. Republicans in Congress have one plan. Democrats have another. There is some overlap, too. We'll sort it out and find out what the child care situation looks like here in Wisconsin. And you can tell us what might help you and your family. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, when the Milwaukee Bucks begin their playoff series against the Bulls this weekend, one woman will be keeping the players and fans hyped for the game, DJ Shauna. We caught up with her this week and asked her what it means to be the Bucks' official producer and DJ. Now, breaking news, Democrats and Republicans kind of agree on something. Both parties in Congress have put forward bills aimed at boosting access to affordable, high-quality childcare, which is hard to come by for many Americans. A recent poll found that just over a third of Americans struggle to find childcare when adults need to work. While they disagree on how to go about it and pay for it, both the Republican and Democratic proposals want to increase the portion of Americans who get subsidized or free childcare and increase the supply of childcare available. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your childcare situation? Are you able to afford childcare? Did you or your partner have to stay home for it to work, whether you wanted to or not? What might help you the most as a parent? If you work in childcare, what do things look like from your side of things? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ruth Schmidt is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. Ruth, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. It's good to be here.
What are we seeing from the two parties in Congress, first of all, on the accessible and affordable childcare issue?
So I think I'd open by saying the first thing we're seeing is probably the closest we've come in as many years as I've been working in this field, which is over 20, to actually see bipartisanship happening when it comes to childcare. I think there is a strong understanding in our country, and it became more and more clear throughout the pandemic that childcare is critical. It's a market failure. We need to do something to stand it up, to support working parents. I think how the Republicans and the Democrats come at it are slightly different, but I think there's significant room to come together. and some significant room for optimism in this.
Before we dig into some of the details in Congress, let's bring things home to Wisconsin. Can you paint us a picture of the childcare landscape here in the state? What is working? Where do we have some room to improve?
So I'm going to actually focus on where we have room to improve because I think there's a lot of small incremental things that are working. I think we've seen throughout COVID, Wisconsin invests significant amounts of COVID relief dollars that came for childcare, which I think point to models and mechanisms that could be in place in the future that would help to really support a system of early care and education. But when I typically talk about early care and education, it's from the vantage point of understanding that we have an incredible gap between the children who need regulated care outside of the home and care that is available in the state of Wisconsin. So prior to the pandemic, we had a gap of about 40% in terms of care available. So we had over 117,000 children under the age of five with all available parents and guardians in the workforce who could not secure regulated care outside of the home. The impact on this is being felt across our state in urban areas, in rural areas. It looks very different from one place to another, but everyone is experiencing that increasingly parents are struggling to work. Businesses have job openings for over 3 months, 4 months, 5 months. The Bipartisan Policy Center indicates that the economic impact of the gap in care in Wisconsin hovers between $2.8 and $4 billion annually. So significant losses in our economy because we have this incredible shortage of available care for our youngest kids.
Can you talk about this more as a workplace issue? We hear again and again, we don't have enough people to fill positions in jobs around the state and around the country. But a lot of families, I was here, you know, when my kids were little, you weigh how much would you pay for childcare versus how much do you make going for work? Sometimes it makes more economic sense not to work. Is that part of your selling point to take action on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're hitting at a really good point here. And this is what really, when we talk about market failure, this is it, right? So we know that there are parents out there that are demanding care, that need care, and simply don't have the income to purchase the care that they need to be able to work, right? When childcare is hovering at approximately $10,000 to $12,000 a year in Wisconsin, depending on the age of your child, depending on which market you're in, not many households can easily make that kind of payment for care. It's chewing up upwards of 15 to 30% of median household incomes, depending on what market you're in. At the same time, you've got providers that want to be able to fill the necessary gap, right? They want to be able to provide care. They want to be able to meet the need of children and families in their communities. They want to be able to support the economy. But they can't do it because they can't charge any more money, right? And so you've got these two forces, revenue and demand versus availability and cost. And it simply is not working for many, many families. And then what we see in childcare itself is that three quarters of childcare programs are currently trying to hire people. So we have open classrooms that are sitting vacant because programs can't hire staff. They've reduced hours, they've increased wait lists. And when you look at this workforce and you see that they're earning close to poverty level wages, high levels of reliance on public assistance, despite having education, despite having years of service, we really are in a fragile place when it comes to sustaining care and meeting the needs of working parents at a place where they can afford to have their children.
Talking to Ruth Schmidt, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association, about childcare shortfalls in terms of accessibility and affordability in Wisconsin and beyond, efforts in Congress to try to help close that gap. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Dave is with us in Toma. Dave, hello.
Yeah, hi. I've just got two quick points to make, and then you can talk about it off the air. One is I just don't have a lot of sympathy. If people, why are people having kids they can't afford? That's my first, my starting point. I don't have a lot of sympathy. And the other one is the standards for child care have gotten ridiculously high. And if we lowered the standards to where they were back in the 70s, where there was a lot of people offering private daycare and things, the cost would come down and it wouldn't be such an issue.
Dave, thanks for the call. Ruth, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think first I'd say it's pretty common to hear this question about families having children that they can't afford. I think the one thing I'd want to point out on that is in Wisconsin, we lead the nation in babies with mothers in the workforce. Now, this isn't, so the national average of babies with moms in the workforce is about 61%. And in Wisconsin, it is over 70% of babies have moms in the workforce. This isn't necessarily because just because moms want to work. This is a function of sort of the reality of our economic system, right? We already have a workforce shortage in Wisconsin. And if we were to take women out of the workforce to be home with children when they're young without replacing it with something, I think all it would do is make the current economic situation, the current workforce issues that we're struggling with, that much worse. I don't think anyone is saying what is right or wrong for a family. That is obviously something that should be left up to families. But the economic reality of our country and our state in many, many cases is that you have all available parents in the workforce in order to make household function and in order to help our economy function and the workforce as a whole in Wisconsin. So that's the one thing I'd say about that. And then in terms of lowering standards, I can tell you that this is one that sort of always gets my, it gets me on edge when I hear people talking about this, because the bulk of brain development is happening with children under the age of three. This is when like 80 to 90% of the architecture of the brain is developing, language is developing, social emotional skills, which are the foundation for all future learning, are developing. This is a time when we need our children to be in the best possible care with educated early childhood educators working with them, caring for them, providing developmentally appropriate care for those kids. This is has been studied up one side and down the other in terms of what is best for children, what is best for their long-term health, what's best for success in school. And if you talk to people that work in the workforce of early care and education, I think you would hear over and over again, please do not water down the standards and the requirements because what we do is so important and we need to have the protections we have in place and we need to have the adult-to-child ratios that we have in place in order to do our jobs well.
Thanks for the call, Dave. We're talking to Ruth Schmidt, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association, talking about bills in Congress that have passed would make childcare more affordable and accessible. That's their goal anyway. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you work in childcare, what do you wish people knew about your job? What are your thoughts on the levels of pay and compensation? If you need childcare as a parent, what are you seeing out there? What are you not seeing out there right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Ruth Schmidt, the Executive Director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. We're talking about proposals from both sides of the aisle to make childcare more accessible and affordable. Still time for your calls with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences working in childcare, looking for childcare. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now with Dana in Appleton. Dana, hello.
Hello. So I'm a single mother that I work part-time and I go to school, and I have two children, one of school age and one that's 3 years old. And they're currently at a daycare that is charging me $1,800 a month for a full-time kid, 3 years old, and a kid who's there for 5 hours a week. And they know how much I get for state aid, or, you know, before any of the situation happened of me, you know, it being transferred in my name and everything like that. And it's almost like I feel like the daycare center almost knew how much I was going to get, and like they charge more than what that is. And yeah, it's just crazy. And then to find another daycare center that is willing to take a kid of my age, of their ages, and there's a waiting list that's so long, I don't know if I'm going to be able to work because of that.
Dana, thanks a lot for the call. Ruth, that's the kind of story I'm guessing you hear fairly often.
We do hear that story very often, and thanks for the comments, Dana. And I think this points to the need for one of these bills, either the Republican bill, the Democratic bill, or some compromise between the two for us to move something forward so that individuals in Dana's situation have access to affordable care. I think what's tricky about these situations, we have a shortage of care in Wisconsin. We have waiting lists in childcare programs, in some cases up to 6 months to a year. The running joke is, as soon as you find out you're pregnant, you need to get on a waiting list so that you have your care available when you give birth to that baby. This is a huge issue, Dana. And the perspectives are in tension with each other, right? Like, I hear you. I definitely hear how hard it is to have to face making that type of a payment every month. When we look at how care is, how childcare programs operate, the margins are razor thin. No one is making money in this industry. If they were, we wouldn't have a shortage of it, right? Like, if this were a business model that worked, we would have no shortage of childcare programs because we would open them and they would operate successfully. But even though $1,800 a month sounds astronomically high, when you figure that into the cost of operating a childcare program, paying mortgages, utilities, insurance, food, supply, curriculum, materials that you need for your classrooms, let alone staff, you find out that there's just not enough left over. So there's no good answers, honestly, without a significant public solution to this. And by public, I mean a government solution to ensuring that there's tax dollars that are going in to support childcare in a bigger way for working families.
Dana, thanks for that call and good luck to you. Before we go back to our callers, Ruth, can you talk more now about what is in those Democratic and Republican plans, some of the key items that you might, that there's some overlap even, that might help out with that situation you just outlined?
Yeah. So I think the encouraging things that we see in both the Republican and the Democratic proposals are hoping to get to a cap on the amount of household income that would need to be paid for care, and that cap would be at no more than 7% of household income. It differs in terms of, for the Republicans, their bill would sort of cap out with families at approximately $142,000 nationally. That would be the national average. And for Democrats, it goes up to about $240,000 of household income. So more families served under the Democratic bill, fewer families served under the Republican bill, but the Republican bill, as it is presented, would go a long way to supporting many, many more families and income constrained families in Wisconsin. The other pieces that are similar is that both are built on this desire to have family choice, parent choice as to want, where you want your child to be in care. The pieces that I think are problematic to me in the Democratic bill, or in the Republican bill rather, they haven't put a price tag on it. So we have no assurances of what they're willing to actually come to the table with in terms of dollars for this project. It would be a continuation of the Child Care Development Block Grant that's existed for many years. Wisconsin uses that to support subsidy for people who need it in Wisconsin. The Democratic bill, what I like about it, many things, but one is that it also includes a very targeted increase in wages for people that work in this field so that we could hopefully turn the corner on shortages of workforce coming into this field. We could get them the training they need. They could get benefits, they could be paid commensurate with their levels of education. So lots of good stuff in both, slightly different ways of achieving it.
Talking to Ruth Schmidt from the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association, looking at a child care gap in Wisconsin and around the country, some plans in Congress aimed at tackling that problem. Back to your calls now. Shalina is with us in Appleton. Shalina, hello.
Hello. I am an elementary school teacher, and our school has recently provided public 3K and 4K classrooms. Watching what goes on in the classroom and the struggles that we are having, I see some frustrations with that. And after living in Germany for 3 or 4 years, I noticed that in Europe, you have the families are far more empowered because of the family leave and child care income credits and those to support the families to be able to have that time with their children at home and not be forced to work and to have to put your kids in child care. And I just wonder if we can move this political conversation from providing universal child care into what can we do to provide parents the best options for them.
Shalina, thanks a lot for that call. Ruth, could that be part of the solution, more family leave so that a parent doesn't have to make that choice between do I go back to work or pay for child care or not?
Yes, I think it should definitely be part of the conversation that we're having, but I think that's a harder part of the conversation. And lots of European countries get this done well. They provide that type of support for parents upon the birth or adoption of a child. So you've got some time to be away and be with your child and bonding and everything that you want to do as a new parent. They also provide considerably public supported options for childcare when it is time to be back at work, right? So they do it correct on two different levels. In our country, I think we're struggling with both, right? We don't have a decent level of paid family leave that's required to support moms and dads when they have children. And we certainly don't have the supports that we need when it comes to the child care infrastructure. The other thing that I would just really briefly say is when you're talking about children coming into four-year-old kindergarten, we often hear from four-year-old kindergarten teachers in Wisconsin that they can tell the difference between children that are coming out of high quality childcare, having had that benefit and being ready to learn when they hit those classrooms, which to me is just another thing I think that speaks to the value of investing correctly in the care that our young children do get.
In just our last half a minute or so, Ruth, are you optimistic that something is going to come out of Congress between these two plans?
I am optimistic that something will come out. I will be probably the first to say I hope it can go a lot further than I think it's going to go, but I am optimistic that it's going to be better than what we had in past years.
Ruth, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Ruth Schmidt, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. She talked to us today about two bills aimed at making affordable child care more accessible to more Americans. One plan from Republicans in Congress, one plan for Democrats. As we heard, a fair amount of overlap. There is still time for you to share your thoughts or maybe your experiences or your solutions. You can do that. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you think. You can also always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Dig past the headlines on the top Wisconsin news of the day on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent every weekday morning. Tomorrow at 8, a lot of districts saw votes on school funding around the state, including one close recount. Find out what happened and what it means for schools and students, and maybe join in with a report for what's going on in your own community when it comes to school funding. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. A while back, I mentioned the strange home remedies that we sometimes get as kids. Like I got Coke syrup for stomach aches and Werner's ginger ale for everything else. Seems like a pretty common theme. A lot of my Central Time chums had similar experiences. Well, I asked you if you had anything like that. Here's an email from Anne in Madison. Anne writes, as a kid, I was always given a teaspoon of granulated sugar for hiccups, which worked every time. So a spoonful of sugar does have some medicinal benefits. Anne goes on, another recommended cure for hiccups was to drink water while upside down. I think you were supposed to bend over at the waist and drink, but could never quite work out the logistics of this, so don't know if that works. I've heard that one too, Anne. Never quite figured it out either. I try to help other people out with their hiccups by scaring them, but it's a thin line between not scary enough and too scary. How do you cure your hiccups? What works for you? What wisdom have you tried that failed? Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. If you're dealing with hiccups right now, boo! Always happy to help out. This is Central Time.